You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Eliane Glazer. I'm a writer, radio producer and author of Get Real, How to See Through the Hype, Spin and Lies of Modern Life. And I'm delighted to welcome you all here today for this RSA Thursday event. So Matthew D'Ancona writes a weekly column for The Guardian, and he's a regular contributor to the Evening Standard, the New York Times and GQ. He was the Spectator editor and Sunday Telegraph's political columnist and their deputy editor for many years. And he's also a visiting research fellow at Queen Mary University of London and author of several books, including In It Together, The Inside Story of the Coalition. And he joins us today to discuss the new post-truth era and how to fight back. And clearly, this is an urgent issue. We've seen, you know, the rise of social media, including Twitter, I have to say. The Brexit campaign and the misinformation there. Trump's election. And interestingly, accusations of fake news often come from Trump's tweets. So what's going on? Matthew's written an admirably polemical but also nuanced book, which I hope will be able to enlighten us. Matthew.
Well, thank you very much, and it's particularly nice to see you all here and also to be introduced by Ian, who's a real pioneer in this field. And it may be an odd thing for someone who's promoting a book to say, but go and buy hers, because it's really good. There's so many things one could say about this, so I shall kick things off and then we can get into a debate, because I think that's always the best way to approach something like this. The first thing, this whole post-truth business is, the first question people tend to ask is, surely this is nothing new. And they'd say, you know, haven't human beings been lying to each other since they could communicate? What about Watergate? What about Bill Clinton's impeachment? What about the Iraq dossiers? What about spin? And for those who are minded to go back a bit further, what about Machiavelli's advice to the prince to be a great pretender and dissembler? In other words, haven't we been, this is all part of human existence and communication since language began. And I say yes to all of that. I mean, mendacity is as old as language itself. Falsehood has always been a feature of the human condition. And you can tell a politician is lying because, well, you can fill in, you know, the rest of the joke. But post-truth is something else, and something new, in my view. And the novelty is not to be found in the lies, but in our response to those lies. It's about us, not them, if you want to put it another way. Now, as many of you may know, in 2016, Oxford Dictionary selected post-truth as its word of the year, defining it as, I'm quoting, circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. And I think that gets right to the heart of the matter. Let's look at some examples, first of all. If you take last year's Brexit referendum, please take it away. Aaron Banks, whom you might know, was one of the big spenders in that campaign, but also a backer of UKIP for many years. Very sharp-witted businessman. He bankrolled the Leave.eu campaign, which was not the official campaign, but was very important, I think, to the outcome. And Banks was, what everyone thinks of him, correct in his analysis of the outcome. He said, and I'm quoting again, the Remain campaign featured fact, 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 fact. It just doesn't work. You've got to connect with people emotionally. Now, that rings horribly true to me, because as a Remainer, you know, we were pressing for Britain's continued EU membership, but we were doing so by bombarding the public with statistics. Leaving would cost 950,000 UK jobs, the average wage would fall by £38 a week, each family would pay an average of £350 more on basic goods, £6 million invested by the EU countries in the EU would be at risk, the cost of leaving would be £4,300 per household more, and so on and so on and so on. It's exhausting statistical overload. And it became easy to caricature this torrent of indigestible data as no more than a series of arbitrary claims. And what the Brexiteers understood was the need for simplicity and emotional resonance. They were looking for a narrative that would give visceral meaning to a decision that might otherwise appear terribly technical and jurisprudential and abstract. And Dominic Cummings, who was the campaign director of the official campaign, Vote Leave, argued at the time that the case for departing the EU had to be clear and to cleave to the specific grievances of the public. So while there were people in the campaign saying that the slogan should be Go Global, which might be intellectually defensible, Cummings understood that it wouldn't win votes. And he had done earlier research on Britain's potential membership of the Euro, when that was a live issue, that had revealed the potential traction of a pledge to take back control, and he was proved right. Meanwhile, after considering a run at the presidency for decades, Donald Trump intuited a similar shift in popular behaviour. I mean, let's face it, he was never a sympathetic candidate, but the opinion polls show that the American people were perfectly aware of his character flaws. It's one of the most interesting aspects of all this. What happened, I think, is he communicated what I would call a kind of brutal empathy to them, rooted not in statistics or empiricism or information, but in a kind of an uninhibited talent for rage and impatience and attribution of blame. So when people asserted, as they often did, that he was plain speaking, they didn't mean, as they might have in the past, that he was speaking the truth. I think what they meant in 2016 when they said that of Trump was, this candidate is different somehow and he might just address my anxieties and hopes, which is a completely different proposition. So when Kellyanne Conway, the senior aide to the president recently elected, spoke famously of alternative facts, she was capturing perfectly, if inadvertently, this new epistemology. In the post-truth era, what used to be called reality was becoming fungible. The point is not to determine the truth by a process of rational evaluation, assessment and conclusion, the old Enlightenment model. You just choose your own reality as if from a buffet to suit your emotional needs. And I don't think it's in any way a coincidence, we can talk about this more in the discussion perhaps, that there's been a resurgence of conspiracy theories, of pseudoscience, anti-vaccination, and most appallingly of Holocaust denial. Now, how has this come about, this change? Well, the social basis of post-truth, I think, is the collapse of trust in traditional institutions. There are many factors, but all else flows from this single poisonous source. The financial crisis of 2008, I think, still continues to reverberate around the world. It took the global economy to the brink of meltdown. It was only averted by eye-wateringly huge state bailouts for the very banks that were responsible for the collapse. In Britain, just to take one example, this was followed very quickly by the humiliation of the political class in the 2009 parliamentary expenses scandal, revealed by the Daily Telegraph. Meanwhile, there were scandals in show business, especially the monstrous sexual crimes of Jimmy Savile, which dragged the BBC and other broadcasting institutions through the mire. Print journalism had its own experience through the hacking experience, the hacking controversy, no less of a disaster, which forced the closure of the News of the World, the resignation of its former editor, Annie Coulson, as number 10's director of communications, a huge job, and then Lord Leveson's sweeping inquiry of 2011-12 into the conduct of the press. That's just the British example. So in other words, we live in an age of institutional fragility. A society's institutions act, or at least used to act, as kind of the guardrails. They were the bodies that incarnated its values and its continuities. To shine a bright light on their failures, decadence, and outright collapses has happened is intrinsically unsettling, but that's not all. What's happened is that post-truth has flourished in this context. It's as if the firewalls and antibodies, if you like, to mix metaphors, of our system have weakened. And when the putative guarantors of honesty falter, so inevitably does truth itself. Secondly, and related to this, digital technology has become the all-important, primary, indispensable engine of this change. Now, in the early years of the online revolution, It was optimistically assumed by many, myself included, that the internet would inevitably smooth the path to sustainable global cooperation and pluralism. And I still think it's worth saluting the achievements it has made. Very unfashionable at the moment, the digital revolution, but it has done amazing things. The trouble is it's also done at least as much to foster, if you like, balkanization and a general retreat into echo chambers. Barack Obama put this very well in his farewell address. He said, and I'm quoting, "We become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there." So, for all its wonders, the web tends to amplify the shrill and to dismiss complexity. And for many, and perhaps most, it encourages confirmation bias rather than a quest for accurate disclosure. As Eric S. Raymond famously predicted, the cathedral, the old structure, is yielding place to the bazaar. And there are profits to be made from this, the production line of clickbait hoaxes, unscientific medical claims, crackpot theories, fictional sightings of UFOs or Jesus. And the disincentives to publications so far are marginal. The ease of production is enticing. For those on social media, anonymity dramatically reduces accountability. And the buzz of the hive sends the falsehood fizzing into cyberspace to do its work. Never has the old adage that a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its boots seemed so timely or worrying. So in the consequent cacophony, the flow of information is increasingly dominated by peer-to-peer interaction and recommendation rather than the old-fashioned imprimatur of the traditional media. We consume what we already like, and we tend to shy away from the unfamiliar. So, massive irony, the ultimate generator of novelty has also become the curator par excellence of hearsay, folklore, and prejudice. And the really crucial point is that this is not a design flaw. This is not an unintended consequence. It's what the algorithms are meant to do. It's what they're designed to do. They're meant to connect us with the things we like or might like. They're fantastically responsive to personal taste and fantastically blind so far to veracity. The web is it's a kind of dream vector for post-truth, precisely because it's indifferent to falsehood, honesty, and the difference between the two. And that's why what we call fake news now has become such an issue, especially on Facebook. Going back to 2016, among the most read hoax stories of that year were the following. The claim that Obama had banned the Pledge of Allegiance in schools. The story that Pope Francis shocks the world, endorses Donald Trump for president, releases statement. A report that Trump was offering free one-way tickets to Africa and Mexico for those who want to leave America. And ISIS leader calls for American Muslim voters to support Hillary Clinton. Now, you listen, they are funny until you look at some of the research. As ludicrous as these stories may seem, they appear to command a measure of belief. In December last year, an Ipsos poll of more than 3,000 Americans found that 75% of those who saw fake news headlines like this judged them to be accurate. So if digital technology is the hardware, post-truth has proved to be an incredibly effective software. It reduces political discourse to a kind of video game in which endless play on multiple levels is the sole point of the exercise. Conspiracy theories, pseudoscience, Holocaust denial, all, as I said, all of them are enjoying a new lease of life and unprecedented circulation. So, before we all slash our wrists and give up the ghost, let me say that the reason I wrote the book was because I'm an optimist and I think that actually there is a lot that can be done. And in conclusion, I'd just like to touch on some of the things that I think can be done to push back against this. The first and most important thing to recognise is that in any cultural development, political development too, actually, there is no pendulum. There is no inevitable swing back. I mean, if politics in its volatility has taught us anything in the last few years, it's that things don't just swing back. People don't just get bored of one party or one cultural configuration and go back to the old system. That time, if it indeed it ever existed, is past. So the way to deal with post-truth has to involve action. The first kind of subheading of action I would note is what I call the scrutiny spectrum, which is a spectrum of activities which range from fact-checking, wonderful growth of fact-checking as an industry, really, now, that is something that's sprung up in the last 12 months. And it's really incredible how many terrific non-profit, mostly, organisations are really getting to grips with real-time verification. Now, it's an incredibly difficult task, but it's the speed with which these things are happening really gives me cheer, full fact, first draft, things like that. And they also, as well as actually testing the BBC's reality checks, another good one, as well as testing the claims of politicians and other public figures, they conduct post-facto analyses of campaigns and so on to see what was right and what was wrong. And I think this is not to be sniffed at. At the other slightly more extreme end of the scrutiny spectrum, there is litigation, and there have been cases in Germany and France of people who've said enough and have taken tech giants to court. And I think that in cases that is necessary, and it has a cultural ripple effect. Above all, I think that we need unambiguously, and the RSA is a fantastic place to talk about this, to say that digital literacy should be a compulsory subject from primary school upwards. That teaching children how to handle the web is at least as important as teaching them how to read and understand traditional texts. They're not just going to be citizen journalists, they're going to be citizen editors. They're going to have to learn new skills of discernment and evaluation. And I think we're in the foothills of that, but it is incredibly important. At the other end, leaving the scrutiny spectrum aside, you have the tech giants themselves. Now, it's no accident that since what happened in 2016, Facebook, Google, Apple, and the others have all suddenly shown an interest in behaving well. Because before then, there was a kind of collective arrogance about these companies, which was born of a combination of enthusiasm for what they could offer and ignorance about how they actually worked. And as people are starting to realise that in fact they're not free services at all, we give them their attention and they sell it. There's an equal understanding that there are responsibilities that come with their power. And my hope is that they will self-regulate, because I think that's always preferable to government regulation. But it is a fact that, just to take Europe, Britain, France and Germany are all looking very hard at what they will do if the tech giants don't sort their act out. Now, regulating global companies is a business of immense complexity. And again, this is a very germinal movement. But I think that the days when the tech giants could just simply claim total impunity and particularly propagate the myth that they were platforms and not publishers are over. And they will have to come to the table. And the best thing really would be if they all went to a table themselves and negotiated a global convention on how to handle the whole issue of what they publish, how they deal with fake stories, what sanctions they impose. At the moment, the sort of flagging up of contested data simply isn't enough. But they certainly have the technological capacity to do whole lot more than they're doing at the moment. And funnily enough, there's some fascinating work being done on AI and its ability to analyse what is true and what isn't. Very early days there again. But when the tech giants say there's nothing to do with us, which they still occasionally do, don't believe them. The final couple of points. Facts aren't enough. Post-truth will not tumble under the bombardment of more and more and more data. We now have a duty as supporters of liberal democracy to communicate facts in a way that recognises emotional as well as rational imperatives. And that this is a very, very difficult task. To take a micro example, there's a new technique called motivation interview, which a lot of doctors are using. And the reason that it works is because instead of just the doctor saying to the patient, "You're ill, shut up, this is the treatment," the doctor takes the patient through a series of very emotionally intelligent questions about their behaviour, about their needs, and about what lies ahead. And it's been shown to work dramatically better as a way of taking patients through the process that lies ahead of them if they have not just serious illnesses, but any form of illnesses. It's a complete reconfiguration of the old expert versus consumer model that has dominated medicine. And I think it's an interesting model for how other areas of communication might work. Politicians, for example, really do need to align factual claims with emotional significance. You know, obviously, they shouldn't sacrifice veracity to theatricality. That would be a disaster. But we've seen examples. I mean, my own particular favourite was when Theresa May was asked about nurses being forced to go to food banks. And instead of even mentioning the appalling nature of that, she started to spout statistics about the NHS. Now, that is not good enough, and it's also fantastically counterproductive, and degrades the political process. The politicians of the future need to recognise the adulthood of the voters and not infantilise them with a kind of machine gun spray of data. It's very, very important that you come out and you stretch out a hand to the person making the objection, but in taking the hand, you speak to them as if they were grown-ups and not just saying, "Don't worry your pretty little head about it. We've ring-fenced the NHS. Next question." There is a debasement of political discourse, which I think is really alarming, and it needs to be addressed in a communal and collaborative way. It always strikes me, and one thing I always mention is, can you imagine any politician in the developed world, indeed anywhere, giving Kennedy's inaugural address? You know, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." I mean, that no politician would do that because it wouldn't get past the focus group. And we need to return to an honesty in discourse where politicians are prepared to make demands of the public as well as to speak the truth about their own failures. And when one says that, it sounds so obvious, but actually it is completely at odds with contemporary political practice. We've ended up with a kind of bogus, bastardised rhetoric where unattainable promises are matched by unreasonable expectations, and the gap between rhetoric and reality only compounds the disenchantment and the distrust. My final thought I want to leave you with is this, which is, we have to do this ourselves. It's very important that this be a collaborative enterprise, and if necessary, an insurgent one. I wrote the book as a call to arms because I believe profoundly that truth is discovered, not distributed. If we wait for people in charge of corporations or politicians to do this for us, it won't happen. We have to demand the truth. We have to speak out and raise our voices, because passivity is not a neutral act. It's in fact a decision to allow the status quo to prevail, and that in this instance is not acceptable. My favourite political quotation of all time is of Benjamin Franklin being accosted when he emerged from Independence Hall in 1787 after the second drafting, and being asked by a woman, "So, Mr. Franklin, what manner of government have you bequeathed us?" And Franklin turned to her and said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And I think that "if you can keep it" is the absolute core of democratic politics, because the point Franklin was making was, you're going to get your republic, but the forces of tyranny will conspire against you forever, and you have to keep that republic healthy. And in the broadest possible sense, of course, we live in a constitutional monarchy, not a republic, but in the Plato sense of republic, we are all defenders of the republic. So my hope is that the post-truth will face an army of people who are not happy and not content with it and are determined to keep the republic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matthew. So I'd like to start by drilling down, as they say, into the sort of newness of these phenomena, because I think it's a funny way in which the internet sort of gets rid of history, that we just live in this permanent present and actually we can't see the historical context of the moment we're at. And only, as you say, by understanding what's new can we start to diagnose the problems and try and cure them. So, but I would like to talk a bit more about social media because... you know, I mean, obviously, you talk about it in the book, and you mentioned it there, but I'm wondering if we're a little bit too easy on it, in the sense that, as you acknowledge in the book, the advertising model means that there's financial incentives towards clicks rather than truth, which, you know, if you have a decline of the paid journalism model, then the incentives are against truth. And in addition, as you also mentioned, there are much easier ways to manipulate data, as we're seeing in the journalism by Carol Cadwalader, you know, these shady data firms, you know, which are sound like conspiracies but seem to be true, the manipulation of the data by these powerful commercial and political forces. So, and we're also seeing these very vocal attacks on elites, the liberal elites, on experts, you know, which I think is a very toxic alignment of these attacks on elites and the kind of supposed interests of ordinary people. So it's almost as if journalists, newspapers have power. And, you know, chance would be a fine thing, frankly. So I wonder, you know, what you think about these attacks on sort of supposed gatekeepers and experts and, you know, upholders of the truth. And the rise of this commercialised internet social media landscape.
Well, it's such a good point, and it's interesting that you mentioned Carol journalism. If you haven't seen it, do Google it when you get home, because Carol Cadwalader has done an amazing series of articles about the extent to which big data was scraped off social media in the last referendum by a company called Cambridge Analytica, which was associated with at least and possibly owned by a very shady and shadowy figure called Robert Mercer, who in turn turns out to be a great friend of Steve Bannon and one of the main funders of Donald Trump. You're seeing a pattern here emerge, I suspect. And yes, I mean, what the thing about digital technology is we have moved from the gold rush to the establishment of Las Vegas in about 4 years. The initial phase was so exciting and so energizing, and yet suddenly there are five fortress-like tech giants which control almost all the information in the world. I mean, no companies ever, no nations, no forces... has ever controlled as much information about us as they do. They scrape data from our pages and our feeds about our tastes, about who we are, about what we want and what we do, with extraordinary vigor and skill. And they sell it. And then they're able to target information at people in an entirely bespoke way. Now, this is at the very least a deformation of the democratic process, because no one really knows about it. Take a very kind of parochial example: the rules governing, the law governing this in this country, the 2000 Act, is just now totally out of date. And it needs to be ripped up and started again, because the way in which data is used is so fundamental to voting behaviour. There's a lot of
I mean, it's such early days, but I've been fascinated by the number of Tories who've told me since the election that one of the ways they lost was that their use of social media was so much worse than Labour's, which really surprised them. Now, that doesn't mean that Labour's use of social media was improper. What I'm saying is that these strategies can quite easily shift power. There is almost no transparency about them at all. The ads that are fired into our Facebook pages are not publicly available, unlike posters and so on.
Yeah. And on the subject of power, I mean, another aspect of the newness is, as you say, this tolerance of truth amongst the public. Twas ever thus arguments are problematic because they do obscure the rise of these new forms of power. And do you not think that there's also been a change in terms of political accountability, that there used to be, you know, such thing as a resignable offence? Yes. And so there was an ability to track political statements over time, you know, to say, you said that this, then you say that now. It seems like we're losing the ability to hold leaders to account over time. And that's obviously to do with the decline of the journalistic record and also the decline of a powerful political opposition. But isn't it also to do with, you know, the Iraq war and the ability of political leaders to simply say, look, you know, there was misinformation, but actually I can still hold on to power. It just doesn't matter. So it's actually about not so much a tolerance of truth amongst the public, but a resignation to the seeming reality that the exercise of power can shape reality according to its own desires.
Well, exactly. And also because, as it were, political voice used to be identifiable. You would see it in Parliament or in the newspapers or on television or whatever. But now the forces that spread political messages might be bots operating across social media in a way that you don't know at all. So there's that. There's a lack of transparency. But I think you're absolutely right. And I mentioned the decline of trust. I think that the political class in this country has absolutely failed to address this problem of trust, and it has failed to develop a language that acknowledges just how shredded trust in the political class is. And I spend a lot of my time writing about politics, and I'm genuinely amazed by how little change there's been in the way politicians talk. Early Obama was kind of the only exception to that. Early Obama had a kind of eloquence and humility about it, which was very interesting. But we're back to the verbless sentences. I mean, I think strong and stable was it was kind of the nadir of the whole thing. The idea that a public that has been through the kind of processes you mentioned would respond to kind of, you know, really clunky neurolinguistic programming is insulting. I'm a great believer in political humility. I think that people respond very well to it. I'll never forget interviewing Mike Portillo on the morning after he lost his seat in 1997, and he was undoubtedly at that point on the night of 1997 when he lost his seat. He was the most hated politician in the country, but in the interview he did with me, he spoke with huge dignity and humility about he'd got it wrong. He understood that he'd made massive mistakes. The party had to change. He had to change. And I got a huge mailbag about it, because this was before emails, which is slightly embarrassing to admit. Emails existed, but people didn't use them very much. And more to the point, he did too. And I had a kind of little, you know, one of those terrible hope moments where you think, there's going to be a change, and then things carry on as normal. But I really do think that the political class, I mean, what we're seeing at the moment going on in Westminster is the absolute, I mean, if you wanted to kind of dramatise the worst possible impression of what a governing party should do. That's it. Which is, there's an election, and you, and what do? You say, nothing has changed, and we're going to align ourselves with an unlovely minority party in order to stay in power.
Turn that on its head and actually say the problem that we have is, along with the decline of the authority of experts and, you know, upholders of rationality and knowledge, we also have attacks on politicians. And actually, the gods now are the corporate and financial forces. And actually, shouldn't politicians have more authority? Which kind of brings us on to the question of what is truth. I mean, I think there's an interesting question around ideology and rhetoric, because rhetoric gets a bad press. You know, politicians who are ideological, they get a bad press. You know, it's only the other side who are ideological. We're simply doing what works. And actually, isn't it the case that rather than truth and lies, what we need is a sort of sincere ideology from our politicians? They should sort of stand up and be proud and assert their position and be confident of their ideological position rather than being sort of humble technocrats, just saying we're doing what works.
I couldn't agree more. I think honesty is strength. I don't think that ideology or rhetoric necessarily corrodes truth at all. I think that often it's vehicle, not invariably, of course, but I'm... You know, I find appealing your idea of politicians seizing the moment and saying, I mean, it would be wonderful to have a politician who said, isn't it kind of strange that the world is now dominated by five big companies, and what are we going to do about it? I'm not hugely optimistic about that happening in the near future, but I think it will happen, actually. I am an optimist, and I do think, I look at the young... I'm a father of two teenagers, and I look at them, and I see the youth vote in this election, and I think the next generation actually is terrific. I really do, and I get very annoyed when people sort of roll out the standard complaints about millennials, because I think, you know, they have a much harder time than certainly my generation did, and I think that they won't put up with it. Now, whether we can wait that long is a separate question, but I absolutely agree with you. I think politicians need to reclaim their position. And the corollary of that, which was implicit in your question, is we need to give them the space to do it. Because one of the difficulties of the current kind of the rules of the game, if you like, is that we hate all politicians, with a couple of exceptions. You know, some people get a pass, but not many. We have to make a collective decision about whether we want our representatives to be our representatives and for their lives to be possible, because I'm of an age where I'm watching some of the best people of my generation leave politics because they cannot stand it any longer. And I'm not asking for them a great wave of sympathy for them. It's more enlightened self-interest. We don't want the good people to leave. We really don't. Particularly women, actually. I think, you know, I think one of my great heroines is Stella Creasy. The way that she stood up on social media to these absolutely disgusting attacks is really admirable. But not everyone has her kind of strength. And I think that what's concerning is a generation of people coming through who might just not want that to happen.
Yeah. And one more question before I turn over to you. And I suppose I felt you were a little bit hard on postmodernism in your book, in the sense that, you know, to me, those the critics that you discussed, you know, obviously Marx, Adorno, Baudrillard, you know, they were critics of, you know, the ideology critique. They were denouncing the very kind of post-truth phenomena that we see now. And also, I suppose, the way I see postmodernism, we don't want to go too far down that road, but it was about the construction of truth. It wasn't about, you know, there's a difference between saying that truth is constructed through these ecosystems of verification, authority, and academic consensus, and so on, and relativism, on the other hand. And actually, you know, isn't it important in terms of teaching the young to invest in these kind of institutions of authority that have, you know, scientific method and so on? How do we get to the truth? And those, and to my mind, it's those delicate ecosystems of authority and verification and truth that are being hollowed out.
I think it's interesting that without getting into a long debate about postmodernism, which is normally clears a room, It's funnily enough, it's been one of the, to my great surprise, it's been one of the most controversial chapters in the book. Just in sum, all I was really trying to say in that chapter was that I think that the some of the aspects of postmodernism have seeped beyond the walls of the academy into a kind of pernicious relativism. I think you can indeed have a very interesting debate about, you know, what these thinkers were trying to achieve. And I do say in the book that I think some of the things they achieved were excellent. But I'm not implying that Donald Trump sits up at night reading Baudrillard, because I think that's slightly implausible. But yes, exactly. What I do think is the case is that. There is a difference between pluralism and relativism. All I was really trying to say in that chapter was there's a difference between pluralism and relativism, and we are dangerously close to the latter.
Yes, that theory has been turned to ill. Yes, yes, exactly. So, questions. I'd like to take three questions, and then we'll... So, gentleman over here in the front row with a check shirt.
My question is around, isn't there fundamentally the issue of the commercialisation of the news? Everything is now up for sale. All the state assets now are privatised. You can't walk down the street with yet another poster sign, display board. Hasn't the news just simply gone down the same route? And the issue is the absence of a sustainable economic model for, if you like, non-commercial news, because isn't that the vehicle by which... I mean, you look at The Guardian right now, they keep begging people to help keep them alive. There's not a model by which, unless you take it at source from the licence fee... to do that. And if you go to the US, obviously it's the extreme polarized model, Fox versus others.
Thank you. I look forward to reading your book, but in the meantime, I was checking the FT online. There's an article of 10 hours ago about Cambridge Analytica having spent £6.5 million in 1 billion micro-targeted ads in Facebook for the latest campaign of Brexit. Now, nobody's going to check the veracity of any of these ads. But if I put an ad in Facebook and it's false, I get done for false advertisement. So is the problem of the echo chambers that they are repeating falsehoods, or the problem that they exist to begin with?
Thank you. It's a question about international institutions. I travelled around the West Bank in Israel recently, and that's a place where the truth is bitterly contested. Yet the response of international institutions, you know, in the face of illegality or stifling of debate or what have you, whether it's Trump or Israel, it seems very ineffective. So do we need to rethink, reinvent some of these, whether it's the UN, whatever, these international responses to the post-truth world?
Well, if I can start with the last question, which is a very interesting one. I completely agree. And funnily enough, I was at the OECD the week before last, which is just rather intriguingly taking on this whole agenda in a very proactive way. And I hope other international institutions follow its lead. There's a kind of a default position in the post-war international institutional order that you don't get involved in that kind of the nitty-gritty of this kind of debate. But the OECD, partly in response to Brexit, I think, feels that it's important now to actually go out and start making a fuss. And I'm delighted by that, because they have the resources, they have the quality of people to do it. You know, think what would be achieved if the UN undertook a similar undertaking. It would be terrific. So a hearty yes to that. Cambridge Analytica, well, you know, you took the words out of my mouth. I mean, the question about what you can put as an advert on social media is sounds very kind of prosaic, but actually it's the heart of this. And The Guardian actually did a whole series of articles on Facebook's community standards, which are, you know, fantastically wishy-washy and clearly aimed at maximising revenue. And I don't think that settlement can survive. And I think that the outing of Cambridge Analytica and other companies is the start of a rolling back of that. We have to be. It comes down to my last point. We have to keep up the pressure. I mean, there's a There's a select committee inquiry into fake news at the moment, which is looking at the tech giants. There is an information commission and an electoral commission inquiry into the referendum. But those are just gnat bites. I mean, they're all excellent, but we need more than that. I mean, it's clear to me that we need a continued pressure. People always end up, we need a royal commission. there's something fantastically pompous about saying that, so I'm not going to say it. But we really do need a relentless, a spotlight to be shone on this. And it can't just be, this is part of the thing. There's a kind of a panicked oscillation to politics at the moment, which is something bad happens, we worry about it for 10 minutes, and then we move on to breakfast. This is a long haul, because we're dealing with an industrial revolution of extraordinary proportions, and we're barely finding out what the right questions are yet, let alone the answers. So this needs total commitment, and it needs networks and organisations that are prepared to work for 10 years, not 10 days. But it's a really good point on the question of the kind of economic models of the commercialization of news and how to proceed. Well, look, there has always been, in modern history anyway, public service broadcasting, public sector broadcasting, principally the BBC, and then the private sector companies. And there's been a long and bitter debate about who owns and how accountable they should be and all that sort of thing. I think the debate is now morphing into something even more alarming, which is, yes, you've got one terrific institution that has, for now, 11 years of stable funding, and thank God we have it. And I'm interested, when I travel around the world, how people say to me, thank God we've got the BBC. The bigger question is how the much maligned MSM media brands are going to find a sustainable economic model of any sort in the future, let alone all the other brands that we need. I think that we haven't really landed anywhere close to finding a means of monetizing good investigative journalism, what the BBC calls slow journalism. It's easy to do clickbait. I mean, that you can generate money easily. What's harder is how do you raise the money you need to fund the next Woodward and Bernsteins? Because investigative journalism, I'm here to tell you, mostly fails. 90% of investigative journalism leads to nothing. So how do you build a business model where, in order to get that 10% of gold, you're willing to put up with 90% of dross? It is so countercultural at the moment. People talk about crowdsourcing, crowdfunding. That may be a way forward. But I think David Frum, on the morning after the conservative thinker, who I think is often right about stuff, on the morning after Trump's election, was asked on a talk show, what should we do? You know, how can we help? And he said, take out a subscription to a newspaper. And I thought that was a terrific answer.
Yeah. Okay, questions on this side?
Thank you. You talked about visual literacy being essential from infancy up. I've got a 5-year-old granddaughter who's going to be much more savvy in this field than I am very shortly. And I wondered if you'd talk a little bit more about how you see that happening at an institutional level, quite clearly, but maybe also just at the personal level.
Thank you. I've got one from our live tweeters, from Nico McDonald. He says, you say that digital tech has become the engine of change, and in what sense does technology kind of have agency over us, and I suppose what are the implications for our ability to kind of control the spread of fake news?
You mentioned digital literacy, but isn't that slightly missing the point, not going back far enough? If anyone has looked at climate change, no, it's actually scientific literacy, which gives us the basis of how we determine what is true. There's now a new school of philosophy, I think I've got it right, called agnotology, which studies basically the creation of falsehoods. So things like words like false equivalence, cognitive dissonance. These have been obscuring the political discourse for decades now, cherry-picking. There's been so many falsehoods in climate science that we've now been set back to the point where, you know, it may no longer be the case where the solutions we've got will actually be applicable, so we've always got to go back to the drawing board. So what do you have to think about scientific literacy?
Oh, hello, yeah. You mentioned five organisations that sort of control information. I'm just wondering, what's the danger of the five becoming 3-2-1? And I wonder if you could also list the five, because it'd be, you know, I've got an idea who you might mean, but it'd be quite interesting to list the five.
Starting from the top, the digital literacy question, which is a fascinating one. Your five-year-old granddaughter knows more than you do, probably, I'm guessing, and if I'm wrong, I'm sorry, because you know a lot. I find that there's a lot of ageism in this, which assumes that people, you know, don't know how to handle technical stuff. But let's take the stereotype, because you raise it yourself. She knows how to handle the devices better than you do, but she doesn't know necessarily how to handle what comes out of it. And I think that the task, and it's not as easy as it sounds, because we're going through a transitional period where the people who will be teaching children are still of an age where they think the internet is something new and groovy, where your granddaughter regards the internet as all around her, and wants the Internet of Things and Alexa and all these boxes in our rooms are developed into things which literally run our houses. The word digital will probably drop out of use. So what I'm talking about as just a first basic step is that kids be taught how to be wary of what comes on their screens. I mean, I mentioned in the book that I did a Google search on the Holocaust and truth, and 4 of the 10 searches that came back were Holocaust denial sites. So, you know, just to take that example, it needs to be taught to children from a very early age that Google is not an Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, if you go do a Google search, what you'll get is things that are linked to your search and other people's searches, but it doesn't guarantee veracity. And that links in. I hope that by the stage your granddaughter is 10, that there'll be a lot more kite marking. You know, this site is kite marked by the following recognised fact checking organisations as reliable on a scale of 1 to 10, that kind of thing. But at the moment, there's really none of that at all, and I think it's a kind of urgent civic task. To link that into what the gentleman said about scientific literacy, absolutely. I mean, you know, please don't imagine that I was saying one or the other. And indeed, I love that phrase Kingsley Amis used to use about pernicious neutrality, which is that there's a huge pressure in the media now to just have a row. So you have one person representing climate change science, in other words, 99.5% of scientists, and then someone who represents a load of old nonsense, and they go at it for 10 minutes, and that's it. And obviously, that's irresponsible journalism, and it needs to be fought back in schools. And that's what I mean. A total aside, but one of the reasons that I'm not entirely happy about the DUP deal is because I suspect that they'll want to get their hands on the education system. But anyway, that's by the by. The question of the power, the tweeted question of the power that technology has over us is extremely important. The danger with technology is a human agency keeping pace with technological innovation. And that is not a new problem. That is a problem that has been innate to human innovation. And this is a big one, because we need to be very aware that the pace of change here is greater than it has ever been. And therefore, keeping ahead of technology and making sure that we are the masters of it rather than the other way around is, I think, the greatest cultural challenge of our times. And I minimise that at all. The five, well, it depends who you ask. I mean, I would say Apple, Facebook, Google, Twitter, and, probably Snapchat or another. I mean, there are people who might differ on that, but there are five. There are usually five. Some people list seven. But they are... The question you raise first is, what if they become one, two, or three, is a really good question. And Amazon, I suppose, is the other one. No one has asked that before, and it's a really good question. What do you do when Jeff Bezos decides to buy Apple? And does antitrust legislation in the States cover it? I don't know. But maybe there's a great constitutional historian called Philip Bobbitt who says that it's very important to have preemptive legislation. That legislation is like vaccination. You need to do it before it happens rather than after. And I would say this is a good example of Bobbitt legislation, that we need to pass laws that ensure that the tech giants cannot amalgamate, because then you really would be looking at kind of science fiction dystopias, wouldn't you?
I did ask, is there anything you can do about it?
Yes.
Can we all sort of on a mass give them
the wrong information? Well, that you see, that's a glorious image, but the trouble is, we all bloody use them, don't we? I mean, after I leave this, I will go and tweet how much I enjoyed it and what a brilliant audience you all were, right? So, go figure.
So I suppose the closing question might be, is digital disengagement still an option? So I'll leave you with that, because we are sadly out of time. Please join me in thanking our brilliantly thought-provoking speaker, Matthew D'Ancona.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.